It is well decided, and we agree, that students do not shed their constitutional rights at the schoolhouse door. However, it is equally well decided that those constitutional rights will be administered in a way that is sensitive to the school environment.
Hello and welcome back to the High School SCOTUS podcast, where two high schoolers talk about the Supreme Court and the Constitution, with an eye to how the law impacts schools and students. I'm Elise Spenner.
And I'm Hannah Saraf. Recently, we've discussed many of the court's most high-profile decisions because they all seem to have huge ramifications for the rights of students and for their safety at school. But Elise and I can both get a little bit lost in the legal details of all these cases because we find it interesting and lose sight of their broader implications and the practical realities of those decisions.
We think it's important not to think about these cases in isolation. Instead, it's valuable to think about their cumulative effect on public schools, on education policy, and on the rights that students possess when they are at school and when they are not. That's why we invited Caitlin Millott, an education policy expert and legal genius, onto the podcast.
Caitlin attended New York University's law school, clerked for various judges, and is now an expert on public education law and policy with a focus on equity-based reform. In the coming year, Caitlin will be a Clemenco Fellow and lecturer in law at Harvard Law School. But before all that, Caitlin was a teacher and academic dean at an elementary school in Brooklyn. Basically, Caitlin is the perfect guest for a podcast that focuses on how constitutional law affects schools and students. We are just so, so grateful that she could join us for this term recap episode. We'll play that interview now. Caitlin, we are so, so lucky you could join us today. You are literally the perfect person to dissect this term with the High School SCOTUS podcast. So we are so excited to have you. And our first question is something I personally like to ask everyone, and sometimes Elise nixes it from the list. But what were you like in high school?
Oh, gosh. Well, I'll say what I think I was like in high school. I hope that it's what other people experienced me as in high school. I was on the high school debate team, which a lot of lawyers are. I loved to argue. I still love to argue. I played basketball. I played sports. I think I was a shyer and less confident version of myself. It's taken a long time to sort of grow into myself and who I am. But I always knew that I wanted to do something that would be good for the world. It would help the world be a better place. And I had that drive, I think, even as early as high school. I didn't know what that would be, but I was like, I want to do a thing that doesn't just make money, but means something. And I sort of had that burning desire to do that. But we were all a little awkward in high school, except for you two. You're the most accomplished high schoolers in the universe. So not you two.
We are certainly still awkward. I don't think those things are mutually exclusive. If anything, they probably overlap a little more than we want to admit.
Fair.
So we knew that you were a public school teacher. What was your first love, teaching or lawyering?
Oh, gosh. Teaching, I think. I was a kindergarten and first and third grade teacher. I spent many years in elementary school, and then I was assistant principal at my elementary school. And something about both being around children and the act of teaching, it's just like such a fundamentally service act. Your whole job is to help someone else grow and develop and nurture, and it trains you to see the good in people. And that's something I deeply care about, finding commonalities and things to love about people that are in this world. And so I loved teaching. I always thought, I think type A people who like to argue, it's sort of always in the back of your head, you should be a lawyer, you should be a lawyer. And so it was something I thought I would do eventually. And that's why it's great, you know, as a professor, I get to do sort of the best of both worlds. I get to think about legal issues and I also get to teach. So it's sort of the perfect intersection of that Venn diagram between teaching and law.
I was about to ask how you found the intersection of these two passions. So how did you go about figuring that out?
Well, I think like all really great things that happen, it was a total coincidence and accident. I was in law school and I had worked in my second year of law school at a law firm. And I had a good time. I thought, this is what I'll do. I'll be an associate at a big firm. And then I took a class with Melissa Murray, who is, you know who she is, and she taught me constitutional law. And I remember sitting in her class thinking, what am I doing with my life? Seeing her at the front of the classroom, I was like, oh, well, this is the thing. And so I ended up working for her. She actually was the one who was like, you should be a law professor. Why don't you do that? And so I was fortunate enough to sort of have her as a mentor. She's now my co-writing partner. So it's her basically who showed me this, what should have been incredibly obvious career path for me that I just hadn't even thought about. And so yeah, Melissa Murray, that's why I'm here.
Oh my gosh. I love that so much. That warms my heart to hear that. That is just amazing.
She's the best. We are all so lucky to have women like her doing the work that she does on strict scrutiny, especially for people like you who are thinking, I hope both of you think about going to law school. Having those kinds of people paving the way is really important. Certainly for me, it was.
So let's talk a little bit about the last term. Do your best in 2 to 3 words, summarize your perspective on what happened at the court this term.
That's a big question. And there are lots of words I could use that are both friendly for this high school podcast and perhaps not so friendly. I would say transformative and regressive. And I think we really saw this court walk back a lot of precedent and what we had previously seen to be well-established rights in a way that is transformative and has really changed the way we think about a lot of different doctrinal lines.
Okay, so we're going to start with the elephant in the room, the thing that most high schoolers have heard about and care about. Obviously, the court overturned Roe this term in Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health. So where does the court go next? Should students be worried about contraception and same-sex marriage rights and things Justice Thomas pointed out?
It's a great point that you raised that although the Dobbs majority takes pains to say, don't worry, this is only about abortion. Abortion's different for some sort of historical reason that, in my view, isn't accurate or well explained by the majority. But Thomas, in dissent, as you say, explicitly says, I'm coming for Griswold, access to contraception. I'm coming for Lawrence, same-sex sexual interactions. I'm coming for Obergefell. And I don't remember who said this, but somebody said either the court means what it says and we should all fear for access to contraception, access to same-sex marriage, or they're hypocrites and they don't. And I think I am much more inclined to take the court at its word and think, well, particularly take Justice Thomas at his word and say that at least a small portion of this court is going to angle for the rolling back of other rights related to this concept of privacy. Now, whether they can get the critical fifth vote on that, I don't know. I don't know if we get a Kavanaugh or a Roberts to sign on, but I certainly think it is a significant possibility that within the next 5 to 10 years, we see legitimate attempts to roll back gay marriage, access to contraception, even same-sex sexual encounters. I think there's a chance these are ruled to be states' rights alone.
The quote you mentioned from Justice Kagan, I think, was very noteworthy because it seemed like the bulk of the court's majority opinion could be copy and pasted into an opinion about contraception and same-sex marriage. And they said it was different because of the fetus, but it really, that wasn't what their opinion was about at all. So that was, I think, what Justice Kagan was pointing out, is that either we should take you at your word, but then your whole opinion just doesn't make any sense. And that was super fascinating to me.
That's exactly right, because I think you're astutely pointing out that if we are to take the legal analysis, which is what we are trained as lawyers to do, whether this court is motivated by legal analysis, I think, is a sort of different question. And whether it's become a fully political animal, I think, is its own line of inquiry. But if we are to take seriously that core of legal analysis, the only thing stopping that from applying directly to same-sex marriage, contraception, et cetera, is the court's pinky promise that abortion is different. And again, based on this strained, in my view, quite strained historical interpretation that cherry picks this country's understanding of reproductive procedures and sort of is profoundly anti-majoritarian given public support for access to abortion. And so I think you're right to point out that if we believe the court has any legal teeth remaining, this could easily be applied tomorrow to Griswold Obergefell.
Something I wanted to ask about connected to what we were talking about the extent to which the ideas and thoughts could go, is what about access to gender confirming healthcare? Where does that fall in this? That's something the court hasn't really talked about.
Your guess is as good as mine. And I think there's real fear that in cases that are coming up throughout other courts that haven't yet reached the Supreme Court, that could be considered very much part of this broader conception of privacy that, as the court will say, does not have real roots in the Constitution. And so I think students should be very fearful, as am I, that gender affirming care, really anything the court could sweep into this broad view of privacy is at stake. And I think, again, in the next few years, we're likely to see a case like that come before the court. And if I were betting, I would bet that that falls the same way that Dobbs will.
I think you're right to see that in the tea leaves. And I also think what's important for me to consider, as I've been thinking about Dobbs and what it means for public schools and education, is even before Dobbs, we saw seriously lackluster sexual education in schools. Now we've seen legislatures seriously cutting back on anti-racist teaching in schools. And so will they not do the same thing for education that informs students about contraception, about abortion clinics in the area? And I'm lucky enough to go to school in California where we have that all through middle school and high school. But is that something that's not going to happen at other schools?
I think we're already seeing it's not just what I'll call these anti-CRT bills. Although it's important to flag that what the right has called CRT is not really critical race theory, which is a higher education legal pedagogy that is nowhere being taught in lower elementary schools. What is being taught are concepts about identity. Who am I? Who are the people around me? Which are age-appropriate skills that students should learn, not just for purposes of interacting with others unlike them, but for their own development of identity. So it's not as if kindergartners are being exposed to Kimberly Crenshaw's law school version of CRT. That's just simply not happening. So it's important to say that it is what the right has very effectively packaged as critical race theory. But it's not just that. You see these sort of the Don't Say Gay bills that are going through Florida and other states that teachers are prohibited from discussing not only their own sexual identity, talking about their partners, their children, et cetera, but talking to students about theirs. There are bills being proposed where teachers are required to let parents know if they receive information about a student's sexual identity or gender identity. They're effectively required to out students. And there are perhaps even the most extreme, what I'll call anti-socio-emotional learning bills. And for those of us who are trained in education teaching, socio-emotional learning is about helping a student understand how to interact with others, how to be kind, how to ask questions. And again, I'll say the right has really effectively packaged attempts to teach socio-emotional learning, SEL, as a extension of CRT, that if we teach students to question their identities or talk about their identities, that's somehow wrong because that belongs only to parents. And so to answer your question, I think, yes, this is happening in the majority of states across this country are proposing bills of this nature. Many of them have already been passed and they are quite far reaching and broad. So yes, it's not just a federal question. At the state level, these are serious bills with serious repercussions for children, teachers, and families.
And I think it's important to talk about this because while abortion's a critical issue, things like same-sex rights and gender-affirming healthcare, these are really at the forefront of what students are thinking about on a daily basis. And contraception, like every kid in my school cares about these things. Obviously, abortion is important as well, but it seems kind of far off. Like, okay, yes, this might happen. But these things are imminent. Like, I am worried about this on a day-to-day basis. And I think that's the scary thing for me is these are things that are super front of mind in my schools. And then it's just like everything is at constitutional risk.
Of course. And, you know, I think even with Dobbs, it's not just abortion, right? It's reproductive care. And any person who needs any kind of access to reproductive care of any kind should care about Dobbs, even if you're not somebody who needs access to what the mainstream will call an abortion, right? And you don't want to terminate a pregnancy. You're someone who might need treatment for some kind of reproductive illness or disease. You're somebody who might want to go to their gynecologist regularly, which you should want to do. You're somebody who is sexually active or is contemplating being sexually active, which many high schoolers are. So Dobbs has implications for anybody who is engaged in any kind of sexual activity or is planning to. If I were in your shoes, I would be thinking about where I go to college, where I start my life. Even now, as I'm thinking about going on the job market full time, I'm thinking about ordering my life around access to reproductive care. And I think it's important that students realize that it's not just abortion. It is really your entire autonomous identity as a woman or a person who is engaging in sexual activity. It really changes how you make life choices in a profound way.
I can really resonate with that because I'm looking at colleges right now. I'm a rising senior. And I remember when I interviewed Professor Vladek for the blog, it was like during the school year, like I was not thinking about college yet. But I remember him saying, oh, you should come to, you know, UT. Also, I was like, oh, I don't know about that one, Professor Vladek. But kind of changing gears. The other case that has been top of mind, at least for me, in the wake of so many mass school shootings and so much danger and just going to school, which seems ridiculous, is Nysarpa v. Bruin. We were curious if you could tell us about what the implications this case has for gun regulations that are supposed to keep kids safe in school, if there aren't.
I think you're right to say that this might not straightforwardly be an education law case, but has incredibly serious ramifications for students at all levels. And top of mind always is a statistic that more children died in gun-related accidents last year than did police officers, which is a sort of shocking statistic, but true in a country that really has deprioritized children's safety in a way that is catastrophic. If I were in your shoes, I would feel unsafe going to school. And so really, though the court in Bruin, again, similar to what it does in Dobbs, says, don't worry, you still can't have a gun in these certain, what they call sensitive places. You can't have a gun at a polling place or a courthouse. But similarly to Dobbs, that's just the court saying right now, we're not deciding that the public right to carry that we say in that case is an unalienable right. You can have a gun in public. We're right now not reaching the issue that it doesn't apply to schools. But the Roberts Court does this a lot. They slowly erode precedent to the point where by the time the issue is squarely before the court, they say, of course, look at our past. This only makes sense. It is a logical extension. And so while Bruin does not right now disturb that you can't legally carry a gun in sensitive places like schools, there's no reason for me to believe that we won't see a case soon that allows guns to be legally on school campuses, which is disturbing given how many guns we've seen brought illegally onto school campuses. And so this notion that the proliferation of guns is somehow helpful, I think, has just been disproven time and time again. So yes, it is deeply concerning for students. And again, the tea leaves are that, you know, the minor protection right now will only be eroded, I think, in the future.
I think that's right. We were talking to Professor Bloker of Duke Law, and he was basically saying, it seems like this concurrence from Kavanaugh and Roberts that copy-pastes, again, the longstanding prohibitions from Heller, well, the other justices didn't really seem like they were a big fans of that. And so how do we know that really has any meaning at all for the four justices that signed on to the majority? And I feel like the reasoning in this case was really scary because it basically said we don't need to look at public safety concerns and we don't need to look at empirical evidence. So will lower courts be able to consider these factors when they determine the validity of gun regulations?
Well, what I think is interesting about that, and I think it's an often overlooked aspect of these decisions, is yes, they're sort of normatively bad in that their words matter to us, that they signal what we value. But most practically, they matter in, as you say, how lower courts will interpret their doctrine, where most of lawmaking happens, which is at the district and appellate court level. Very little, I'm sure you've talked to your listeners about this, but very little of federal case law ever reaches the Supreme Court. Most cases are decided at the district trial court level, or even fewer that are appealed successfully to the appellate, the circuit court level. I think you are exactly right to note that not just in Bruin, but also from Dobbs. The court just applied this sort of cherry-picked historical analysis of these rights. I think lower courts will have a tremendous difficulty applying these modified tests that don't really work as tests. And as a former lower court clerk myself at both the district and appellate level, I would have had a ton of difficulty applying both Bruin and Dobbs. And even cases like Kennedy versus Bremerton, where these tests are sort of being kind of overruled, but not really overruled, that's an incredibly difficult task to take on as a lower court clerk and judge. So yeah, I think all of these precedents are going to have massive implications and lead to really confusing doctrinal splits amongst the lower courts.
So it's really funny you mentioned Kennedy, because we were about to jump into that. So talking about religion, you're a teacher. So can you tell us what the court's ruling in Kennedy versus Bremerton School District from Washington, I have to say it every time, means for the free exercise rights of teachers, but also for their ability to refuse to participate in religious practices at school?
Well, so what's really interesting about Kennedy versus Bremerton and Carson versus Macon and Espinoza and Trinity and all of these cases over the past 5 years that have centered free exercise and establishment is we really see this war between the establishment clause and the free exercise clause and the question of what is freedom from and freedom to, and really the balance there. And the court has really come out quite strongly that individual religious rights of teachers, or in this case of a football coach, are presumptively the most important thing, that this prayer that the coach was able to engage in takes primacy. And in fact, to restrict that prayer in virtually any kind of way would be infringing too far on his individual religious rights. And it's important, I think in the last episode you spoke with Professor Gordon about this, and I think she's exactly right that the court has really misrepresented the facts of what that prayer was. This was not a private head bowed prayer. This was a prayer at the center of the football field, the 50-yard line. And there is testimony that his players felt implicitly coerced to join into the prayer. Otherwise, they thought they would lose their playing time. And in fact, there's pictures that Sotomayor puts in her dissent about this is not a private prayer. And so in misrepresenting the facts in that way, the court has really crafted an entirely different narrative about what his prayer was, when in reality, it was, I think, at the very least, implicitly coercive. And so what that means is really it's a sort of free-for-all in how we're thinking about access to prayer at schools. And what's fascinating about Kennedy is that there's this implicit overruling of Lemon versus Kurtzman, which was a test that the court previously used. And what the Kennedy court says is sort of, we've already overruled that. That's been overruled for a long time, which is not correct. It has never been explicitly overruled. And many precedents rest on Lemon, including, importantly, Edwards versus Aguillard, which is about teachers praying in the classroom. And so to me, it's an open question of now who can pray, who can require prayer, who can prevent students from, to me, it is a minefield of potential legal questions in the wake of this that has really upended how we think about school prayer.
It seemed like the court was very cavalier in Kennedy with just saying, you're going to ignore the Lemon test, and you're also going to ignore coercion, and we're going to ignore endorsement, and we're just going to say that you have free exercise rights and that's all that matters. And school is no different than anywhere else, basically how I read it.
Yes, you're right. And it's, if you don't want to pray, just leave. Unless you are being, as I read it, unless you are being forced to participate, forced to through some kind of commandeering measure. And even then, there's no guarantee that the court wouldn't have misrepresented those sets of facts. So I think you're right that it's free exercise above all and a selective interpretation of free exercise that is willing to misrepresent the record.
Right. And the court, again, seems to totally ignore the fact that teachers and coaches are role models for students. These are people that they value very highly in their life. What do you make of this, that it just seems to be so divorced from reality? How does the court actually return to like seeing what kids and teachers and coaches actually think and actually need?
I don't know. And I think what's really sort of existentially terrifying about the way in which the record is misrepresented from a legal perspective is that when you're a litigant, the record is the record. And on appeal, it is ironclad. And the idea that the court could so selectively emphasize and de-emphasize parts of the record to make its political point goes to my earlier question, which is whether we can believe in this court as a legal body at all anymore. And I think there are real fears that it is feeling so ends-based and political that the legal doctrine is an afterthought. I don't know how it reestablishes its legitimacy. And I think in the coming years, it will only get worse and more divorced from legal precedent. And so I don't have a solution because I am of the belief that the court has divorced itself quite profoundly from legal principles. And I don't know, you know, that's for the enterprising minds of your generation to help us solve, because I think many of us are very fearful of that.
Another case that came up was Carson v. Macon, which students might not feel like such a direct connection to as they do for Kennedy and whether or not they're going to have to pray for their football coach. But that case regarded a tuition assistance program that refused to fund religious education. Can you tell us why this case affects students and the separation of church and state?
I think thinking about Carson, you must think about it alongside all of the cases that I mentioned earlier, the Espinoza, the Trinity, which I know you spoke about in length at the previous podcast, so I won't go too far down that rabbit hole, and alongside Kennedy, and really sort of alongside the court's emerging anti-privacy, pro-religion, theocratic jurisprudence, and that students should be fearful that the way the court is moving is toward an absolute protection of religion in a selective manner. And so if you are a student who is not a Christian Catholic person and you want to go to school in a sectarian environment where your religious preferences or lack of religious preferences are respected, you should be concerned about these developments because they show the court's willingness to prioritize religious expression, public religious expression, and perhaps coercion in a way that is all-encompassing. And so even if you don't live in Maine, even if you don't want to attend a Christian school, even if you don't want to attend a private school, you should be concerned about the theocratic turn the court has taken, particularly if you are someone who is not in what I will call the court's religious majority. You're not Catholic. You're not. And even if you are, you should be concerned about the idea that the court is okay with those views being proselytized on students in the classroom. So yes, I think all of this together is a really terrifying theocratic turn that students should be worried about.
As you did, looking holistically at all this religion and school jurisprudence, it feels like the court doesn't really anymore see the importance and value of having a public school that is distinctly secular, publicly funded form of education by saying that religious private schools can receive the same tuition assistance and that public schools, you can pray in them as well. And it seems like they're just disregarding the fact that public schools is a uniquely American, deep-seated tradition that we have in our country. You see the same thing, and why has that happened, and why is it so important?
It's a fantastic point. It's one that I'm focusing on in my scholarship currently. And so it's interesting because the American state does not provide much aid to families. We don't have universal paid maternity or paternity leave. We don't have universal pre-K. The only subsidy we really provide is public education. And during the pandemic, it became so clear that when public education becomes inaccessible, it really causes the absolute crumbling of our economic, political, social infrastructure. Public education is central to the American project. In fact, Melissa and I wrote a paper entitled Pandemics, a Public Education, a Privatization, about just that, how public education is central to caregiving and care infrastructure. And from the perspective of the court, it's ironic because in so many of its seminal cases, in Brown, in Plyler, et cetera, even as far back as the Pledge of Allegiance cases, in Barnett, in Gobitis, it's always said that public education is central to democracy. It's said this in its dicta. But then across its precedent, it's sort of bit by bit acted to dismantle the public education franchise. and public education's attempts to act as social mobility or equalize. And so we have cases like Parents Involved, where attempts to, which I'm not sure if you've spoken about much on your podcast, but where attempts to racially integrate schools were an overreach. And so the court really struck down the ability of schools to racially integrate, spread their resources. And it's time and time again, the court has sort of prioritized school choice privatization efforts over public education and its ability to act as the democratic tool the court has said out of the other side of its mouth that it wants it to be. And so I think you're totally right that we should be fearful, not just of religious education taking primacy, but really of the bit by bit dismantling of the public education franchise. And what that means for students is massive. The guarantee of education just simply will not be there. And if public education is to go by the wayside, which, by the way, some commentators on the right already have called for, they've called for a fully privatized education system. If that happens, the quality of your schooling will depend on many things, including and most importantly, how wealthy you are and how well resourced your community is, how much your parents know, how savvy you can be about advocating for yourself, and perhaps where you live. And that's what will determine the quality of your education, which will result in just profoundly unequal outcomes. And so, yes, there is a serious threat to what many of us have seen as a guarantee, which is public education.
Something I guess I wanted to ask is that more than ever, students and young people seem set to, I guess, bear the weight of the court's divisive and groundbreaking decisions on climate change and reproductive rights and religion and guns. So what would you tell students that feel really powerless in the face of the Supreme Court's decision?
I think you're exactly right. And I share in some of those sentiments too. I'm privileged enough to arguably be in a position to affect change. And I feel like I'm sort of hamstrung by what I can do. And something that I've been trying to tell myself, and I know people in the legal community think a lot about, is how to remain hopeful when things feel so hopeless. And I get and fully lean into that it can be very frustrating to hear elected leaders say, well, vote. Well, we did that. We did vote. And now you're in a position of power and there's not much you're doing either. And that can feel incredibly frustrating. And so I guess my message would be just the advice I'm giving myself, which is twofold. The first is that cynicism about voting never works. We must continue to get out and vote because that is a necessary prerequisite. It's not enough. But young people who are for the first time able to vote or volunteer, just being politically active is critical because the only way we can combat these terrifying things, unfortunately, is by getting people into positions of power who are willing to make change. And that's at both the state and federal level. And more important than ever are state elections, gubernatorial elections, state representatives, not just for federal government, but for state government, because that's where a lot of these abortion, climate change, et cetera, decisions are going to be made, is at the state level. So the first part of it is be politically active, vote, volunteer, every bit counts, and we all need to be in the fight. I read something somewhere by someone who had been active in the civil rights movement and said, this is in our blood. We've forgotten what it means to have to fight for our rights. And here we are. We have to remember that we are a people who can fight for our rights. And that's going to be your generation that does that. And the second, I think, is really to make your voice heard in a way that I think social media and technology are really a platform that I didn't have as much when I was growing up. But this to me is shifting from a solely legal fight to a real cultural, political, power-oriented fight. And the more we can shift the Overton window, for those of you who don't know what the Overton window is, it's the window of what society deems acceptable. And the more we can work to move the Overton window back to a place where we have reproductive rights, where we are moving towards protecting the environment, the more we can shift the cultural paradigm, the better. And that means getting your voice out there and heard. So be active on Twitter, be active on TikTok, just be active, not just politically active, but like write op-eds, do what you guys are doing. You all are brilliant and so much more tech savvy and invested than we are, and don't lose sight of that. So the first is the straightforward political activism. The second is the cultural activism, like really push back against these narratives of what America is. We can be a different country, but that will require a cultural shift. And underlying all of that is whatever it takes for you to not give up, do that, because we need everyone involved in the fight. There are moments where I'm like, whatever, I'll just move to Montreal and life will be better there. But we can't do that. We have to fight for the people that can't do that. And I am trying whatever I can to remain hopeful. And I encourage people to do whatever they need to do to fight the cynicism monster, because it's so easy to fall prey to it.
My mom is a Canadian citizen, and she has said to me so many times, we could just go to Canada. It feels like giving up, and it feels like we are the people equipped to have this fight. And how can we be the people that capitulate and say we're not going to do it?
That's right. I'm saying be hopeful. I think with that has to come a modicum of realism, that this is not a next year fight. This is not a 5 years from now fight. This is a long fight we are in for. This court will have its current makeup likely for decades. And even when Thomas retires, it will have a 5-4 simple majority that is likely to continue doing much of its similar work. And so we have to be really tactical about our awareness that this is not an easy solution. It's a complicated, thorny set of problems, but ones that must be solved. And it's the knowledge that we must remain hopeful, even as this is a many decades fight, which can be scary. But the great thing is that you were at the beginning of your young adult lives, and this can be your life's work, is untangling this mess that my generation and older has put you in. And I'm so sorry that you have to do that. It's not fair to you, but you can do it.
Well, I gotta say, I'm revved up for my first election now. November. I'm so glad my birthday came before election day, because I was a little nervous. But before we let you go, we want to get your take on one of next term's blockbusters related to students. Mm-hmm. I think you already know where I'm going, but it's Harvard versus Students for Fair Admissions, a case challenging Harvard's affirmative action policies. What way do you expect this case to go, and how will it change on the ground realities for students, especially students applying to college like me?
Yeah, well, I think it will come as no surprise to you how I imagine this case will go. I suspect that we will see the sunset of affirmative action policies in this country. I think if your readers or your listeners are interested in this, the lower court's opinions in these cases, particularly the district court opinion, which is written by a Massachusetts judge named Allison Burroughs, is some 120 pages. It's incredibly comprehensive. And really like a fantastic defense of affirmative action policies. And so the lower courts have both upheld Harvard and UNC's policies as constitutional under the court's longstanding affirmative action doctrine. I fear that next year, that doctrine, like so many others this term, will be upended, and it will be held that it is unconstitutional to consider race in any capacity in determining collegiate admissions. That obviously is massively consequential for public and private universities and for students that are applying to college. Again, it will upend what has been some 25 years of affirmative action jurisprudence. So I think most court watchers believe it will come out that way, despite the lower court's really effective defense, I think, of affirmative action policy.
That is so scary. I think for every student I know, college is almost everything to them, and being able to take that next step at the school they want to go to and not having affirmative action, it's crazy for me to think about. And I think, much like with Roe, our lives have been lived in a world where those things are taken for granted, and I knew it was going to happen, but to say it out loud, like, affirmative action will likely be over after next term. The court will upend again their precedent in, and that's just crazy to hear.
I am interested in sort of how they choose to do it. I think we have a court that is willing to overturn its affirmative action precedent. I think that will happen. The question is how far they go in doing so. And I think there's hope perhaps there that perhaps holistic admissions criteria are allowed to continue. I'm not incredibly hopeful for that, but I am curious as to how affirmative action is overruled. And I think the rhetoric the court chooses either to adopt or not adopt in doing so will be critically important. One of the criticisms of affirmative action precedent is that, I'm not sure if you've discussed this on your previous podcasts, but the court has upheld affirmative action under what's called the diversity rationale, that we like affirmative action because it helps college campuses be diverse places where lots of different types of people can come together and interact. And that's great. But there's been a lot of criticism of the diversity rationale because there are so many other rationales that I think require affirmative actions. There are reparations-based rationales in which we use college admissions to rectify centuries of racial discrimination. There are equality-based rationales in which we allow collegiate admissions to help students who do not come from means or have been oppressed in some other way become equal. There are many other rationales that are not just about having a college campus that looks nice on a brochure. And so I think the way the court chooses to talk about affirmative action in a normative way will be really important in helping us think about racial equality in college and what it means to have public and private education be equalizing in this country. And so I am curious as to how the dicta, the rationale, how that comes down.
So one final general question, and I think also you're right to bring up the rationale. We could perhaps see a more incremental decision than what I might be worried about. But why more than ever is it so important, and we've talked about this the whole episode, but why is it so important for students to be paying attention to the court and to be aware of both the rights they possess and the threats the court poses to those rights?
I think we are at an incredibly unique time in the past 60 years. When I was in high school, it was important that I pay attention to the court because I should be civically aware. But none of my existential, identity-based, life-affirming rights were seriously in jeopardy when I was coming up as a young adult. Towards when I was in college, Obergefell was passed, and that was really the last sort of legal domino for people of my generation to feel represented. And that is all very seriously in danger of being toppled. That whole infrastructure of rights, reproductive, identity, sexual, gender, health, climate change, these are dominoes that can easily fall. It is not hyperbole. It is not a myth. And we've already seen it this term with decisions that have rocked the core of how we think about access to rights. And so 10 years ago, it was important for us to be educated about this. It is essential. You must educate yourself about your rights, what you are entitled to, what you should be entitled to, and you must be active because at this point, you are looking out for yourself and your family and your loved ones. And this is not a court any longer that prioritizes those types of individual life-affirming identity rights. And more than that, the climate change decision is its own kind of worrying because that is a true existential threat in our lifetimes to the literal functioning of this planet. And if you can cast aside the identity stuff, you should care about your survival. And for me, it's a real question of survival. And so avoiding it and burying your head in the sand is not only a mistake, you are not protecting yourself. And so I think it's absolutely essential you educate yourself on the court, you participate, you're active just for your own future. And I hate to be so doomsday about it, but that's the reality. The reality is that your generation, I think, is the make or break one. I think this is where it either goes fully off the rails or there's attempts to sort of right the ship.
Caitlin, thank you so, so incredibly much for your powerful words and for being the teacher, lawyer, goddess of our dreams. We appreciate your time so much. And when stuff starts crumbling down in a year, we want to have a podcast discussion scheduled for July 14th.
I will do that. And I think I realize that it can sound, I hear the words and they can sound depressing and they should be a little depressing, but like, I fully believe in the ability of us collectively to fight back against this. And that is ultimately where I land at the end of the day. In those moments when I feel terrified about where this country is going, it's young people like you and people that are my colleagues. And we have the resources to put up a fight. We do. And it's just a matter of putting the pieces together in the right way. So I remain optimistic, especially talking to people like you who are so engaged. And I just love what you guys do. So thank you for having me.
Caitlin was the dream guest to recap this term, its impact on students' rights, and the transformation of education law. Miraculously, in the first 6 months of the High School SCOTUS podcast, we've managed to produce 10 episodes. And it feels like perfect timing as the term has come to an end.
This season of the podcast, we hope we've done a decent job, at least, of walking you through how free speech, free exercise, and establishment clauses play out behind the schoolhouse gate. We also hope that you enjoyed our timely episodes on the Second Amendment, the court's free exercise decisions, and the state of education law.
We are so grateful to our amazing guests who helped us explain the complex, tangled intersection between the Supreme Court, the Constitution, and the rights that students possess. More than anything, we can't express how thankful we are that you, our listeners, took a chance on two high school students who are passionate about the law, civic education, and their rights.
Don't you worry, though, if you're already hungry for more High School SCOTUS content, because we will be back super soon for a new season with episodes on freedom of the press, affirmative action, search and seizure at school, and so much more. I think we still have a little bit more term recapping in the tea leaves of the High School SCOTUS podcast, at least. As always, you can leave us a rating, drop us a review, and for more coverage of the Supreme Court by teenagers, check out the High School SCOTUS website at highschoolscotus.com. On the blog, you can read oral argument previews, opinion analysis, and interviews with eminent legal scholars. Literally everything you need to stay in touch with the court. That's highschoolscotus.com. We can't wait to see you next time.